You're listening to a punk movie review right here on the Prairie Punk Press Network.
Nobody was making music like that in 73.
Three black brothers from Detroit, Michigan.
What were they called?
They were called Death.
That's a good name.
Have you lost your mind?
Told us you guys might have a record deal if you changed the name.
Absolutely not. We are fighting to maintain our identity.
It's pretty hard to be black playing rock because you had to be Motown if you were black.
White boy music.
We got turned down by every major label.
Hey everybody, you're listening to Punk Movie Review. We're now on episode 7, and tonight we are reviewing a documentary called A Band Called Death. It's directed by Mark Covino and Jeff Hallett, and it premiered at the LA Film Festival in 2012. The film scored 94% on Rotten Tomatoes, 94% fresh, and it also won the Audience Award when it did play in 2013 at the South by Southwest Film Festival. Mark is a New York slash Vermont director, and he has been involved in film and TV production at multiple capacities since 1999. And he is with us tonight on the podcast. My name is Neckbone.
Hi, I'm Jerry Bear, and I've had a migraine for 4 days.
That's too long to have a migraine.
It is.
Any amount of time could be considered too long.
True.
To have a migraine. But 4 days is,
I hope that it's not one that lasts 6 weeks, because that happens to me sometimes.
Yeah, that's no fun.
No. But Mark's fucking awesome. Yeah. I met him through my volunteer work with the Tallgrass Film Festival. So when we started doing punk movie reviews, I knew I wanted to do A Band Called Death. And I knew I wanted to talk to him about it. And I reached out, and he was willing to do it. He's gracious enough to spend some of his time with us answering our questions. And really stoked to have him here. And just want to thank him for his time.
So, Mark, thanks for being here. I got to say, I made my wife watch this documentary with me last night, and she had no idea who Death was. And she's not into the punk world or anything. So she's like, okay, you're going to make me watch a little punk documentary. And she had no idea who that band was or what this movie was. And she'd watched part of the Outhouse documentary with me and was not impressed. But at the end of it, she said that this is one of the best documentaries she's ever seen. And she's
not
a big documentary person. So thanks so much for being on. And
Totally.
Yeah. So...
No. Yeah, well, one of my biggest critics to convince to even watch my movie was my dad.
Yeah.
He was an older gentleman. He was in his 80s and very conservative. And, you know, it took a lot of convincing because he was like, I don't like that kind of music, Mark. I'm like, but it's not really about the music. It's about the family, and it's very spiritual, and I think it'll talk to you. It's about a father and sons, and and eventually he saw it, and he was very proud of it. It was a great moment.
that's awesome. Did he see it at one of the film festivals?
He saw it at the Vermont International Film Festival. We showed it in the theater, which was basically the size of an IMAX, 500-seat theater, completely oversold, and he had his name on his seat. And he's a classically trained portrait artist, so I had art all throughout my life, but he always wanted me to be a portrait artist. He never understood the film thing, and my mom always supported the film thing, but my dad was always against it. And so it was really like that moment, that day, that really convinced him, oh, maybe Mark was right. Maybe this is his path.
Yeah.
And so it was great that this movie kind of opened his eyes to that. And he was very proud of me. And my mom had died years earlier. So it was great that one of my parents got to see it at least.
That's awesome. Yeah. So Which how many viewings had there been by the time it got to Vermont? Because it premiered at South by Southwest, right?
No. So this is a little bit of a weird trip that this film has been on.
Mm-hmm.
We completed it, I think it was just before fall of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And our producers submitted it to all the top tier festivals, because in the film game, really, like when you have your world premiere for your feature, you want to get it played, at least this is what they tell you, you want to get it played in a top tier film festival, which is only a handful of fests. That's Sundance, South by Southwest, Toronto, Tribeca, you know, that's it. Mm-hmm. and the idea is, like, if you play your world premiere, one of those has to have your film first. If you play your world premiere at those, then the distributors are going to come, and then the other film festivals will come, and yada yada. We got rejected everywhere. Nobody took our film. I didn't think we were going to get into Sundance. It was always a pipe dream to me to get into Sundance. I know how political it is. It's not the indie darling it likes to promote itself as. There's a lot of corporate bullshit involved. And I was like, there's no way we're getting in there. And the reason we didn't get in, supposedly, according to one of our producers who had an in, one of our producers was Scott Mosier, who did Clerks, so very much connected to Sundance in that respect. He was telling us, he's like, it's very close at Sundance. Like, Mark, don't write it off. Like, we might get in. The problem is they have another film that's about a musician from Detroit who was forgotten for 40 years. And unfortunately, like, his story deals with apartheid in South Africa, and they're more into that kind of an angle than our family, you know, staying together throughout the years.
Oh my God.
And that was Searching for Sugar Man. So they took that. And also Sony was kind of involved with that even before Sundance, I think. So I was like, whatever. Our film is meant for South by Southwest. We're going to get into South by. We didn't get into Tribeca, and we didn't get into Toronto. And I think South by Southwest was one of the last ones we were going to hear from. And right at the very last minute, we got rejected. And that to me was like a knife through the heart. I was like, this sucks. Like, nobody likes our movie. We're dead. Like, these producers who are Hollywood producers, very established people in Hollywood, kept telling me, you know, we're going to play at one of these top tier fests, and now we're not playing at one of them. Well, what does that mean? Like, nobody cares about our film. Like, we're fucked. And like a couple of months passed, and I was really depressed, maybe near suicidal at that point. But that's happened a couple of times, just because of the amount of stress and work that goes into making these. I was just like really at the end of my wit's end. And then one of our producers called me up and he said, I got great news. We're having the world premiere at the Los Angeles Film Festival. And I was just silent. I was like, what the fuck is the Los Angeles Film Festival? Like, to me, that sounded like the stupidest fucking kind of film festival you could think of. A film festival in Los Angeles? Like, you guys need a film festival? Like, right. I was so pissed and I was confused. I was like, why are you excited about this? And he's like, no, Mark. He's like, listen. He's like, this film festival is like a step below those others. He's like, it's in Los Angeles. It's connected to the LA Times, Film Independent. He's like, it's got all these ins. They send the feature-length filmmakers out to Skywalker Ranch for a weekend to hang out. He's like, trust me, this is... He's like, the press comes to this festival. Like, you will find distribution at this fest. And so he talked me into it. And I was like, all right, let's see how it goes. And it really did end up being like one of my favorite festival going experiences. And it was probably the right place to play our film. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, there's no LA Film Festival anymore?
No, it's gone. A lot of what our film has touched is gone. Michael Moore's Film Festival is gone too.
Wow.
Yeah. It's the luck of a band called Death, I guess. to get to South by Southwest. So our film played LAFF, sold out screenings. The first screening was a blast. It was filled with all these Hollywood celebrities. The whole thing was a Hollywood dream. It was everything I had dreamt of as a filmmaker wanting to make it in this business. you know, all these people coming up to me wanting to shake my hand.
Oh, D.H. Pellegrino or whatever?
Yeah, D.H. came up to me, wanted me to do a doc on him. I was like, we'll talk about it later, man. I was just, I was overwhelmed by everything, you know. I just, I didn't know how to handle it all. But anyway, that's where Drafthouse Films found our film. After, you know, basically over a week of our film playing to rave reviews and packed houses, you know, and we, even the night of our world premiere, we had an after party where I was meeting with every big studio person from HBO to IFC to Showtime. And I was just like, you know, talk to our producers, like go talk to our, go talk to Scott Mosier. He knows how to deal with distribution. I don't. And eventually, like I was told by our producers that Drafthouse had the best deal. They were going to do what I wanted to do, which was a physical release with a ton of special features. I also wanted a gatefolded special limited edition with the Blu-ray on one side and the 45 on the other. So we had an amazing time at Los Angeles Film Festival. It ended up being probably even better than what Sundance or Tribeca or South By would have offered. Like I said, they send all feature-length filmmakers out to Skywalker Ranch. We had our film mixed at Skywalker Ranch, so we actually got to meet our mixer and go on a private tour to show us where they really mix films, because where they were showing the filmmakers was not where they really mix films. It was the more, you know, glitzy big rooms, you know, like, look at us. We're
look at our fancy toys.
Yeah, no, they mix them in broom closets.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he's like, the our mixer is like, this is where we mix Prince of Persia and A Band Called Death. I'm like, oh, cool. It looks like my janitor's broom closet. It was great. I met a lot of great filmmakers from around the world out there. I really connected with the foreign filmmakers. And then the very last day is when Drafthouse Films found it. And out of all those people that we saw, Drafthouse had the best deal. You know, they were going to give me what I wanted, which was physical release, jam-packed with special features. I wanted a limited edition gatefolded like a record, but on one side is the Death 45 and on the other is the Blu-ray, which you can buy at my Etsy, by the way. I have one of the last copies for sale.
Oh, wow. Nice.
You know, they gave us really cool posters. They were selling replicas of the t-shirt. Like, it was awesome. It was everything I wanted for the film. I wanted merch because it's, I wanted to treat it like it was a band going out on tour, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And I'm also a film fan and I love physical media and stuff. And so we went with them, and then the film started playing other festivals immediately after LAFF. I don't know if our producers submitted it to those festivals or if those festivals just reached out because of LAFF. Usually when you play a big festival, other festivals get a hold of what's doing good and they want a piece of that. And you know, one of our next festivals was at IDFA, the International Documentary Festival in Amsterdam, and that's kind of like the Sundance of documentary film festivals. It's huge. And then shortly after that, we played at the Vermont International Film Festival in Vermont. And that's where my dad got to see it for the first time. And that was an amazing screening because that was kind of bringing it home, showing it to all of our friends and family in Vermont. I mean, it was a packed 500 seat theater. It was oversold. They had to do a second screening.
Which Hackney was from Vermont? Was it Dennis?
Well, none of them
are not from Vermont, yeah, but lived in Vermont. Living for a while.
They all lived in Vermont.
And was
that
at the same time?
Yeah, basically what happened, the reason these guys ended up in Vermont was because they had a relative in Vermont who was a part of a cult.
Oh.
And he, some kind of weird religious cult, but he convinced them. He's like, come to Vermont, man. It's, you know, it's a music hub. It's growing. You know, you guys, you're not making it in Detroit. You could probably make it over here. Mm-hmm. And so they moved to Vermont to try to make it, and they did their religious rock band called the Fourth Movement there. And
yeah,
and actually they did try doing Death briefly as seen in the movie, and they kind of, yeah, you know, basically got told no.
Put up flyers all over a small Vermont town that said
Death
on them.
Death flyers, and that just didn't fly. And you know, Vermont is one of the whitest states in the country. So that didn't work. And they tried the religious thing. That didn't work. They got bad reviews for that, even though amazing music. You know, I'm not big on Christian rock music, but that was fucking badass music that they did for that band. And then they found reggae. I forgot how they found reggae. But that was a hit in Vermont, obviously. white deadheads. This was before Phish. And so, you know, they started doing kind of reggae jam sessions, and they created the Reggae Fest, and I got really big. But David Hackney, just like, he wasn't into the reggae thing, and he kind of moved away from that. So he went back to Detroit. But the two brothers, Dennis or Danis, I always say Dennis, Danis and Bobby, stayed in Vermont and basically just built their families in Vermont. They ended up actually buying a house that was part of the Underground Railroad, and that's where they live, and they have their recording studio there, and it's great. You know, they gave birth to amazing musicians that are now in a punk rock band called Rough Francis.
I didn't realize they were still in Vermont. I thought for whatever reason they were back in Detroit. They're still in Vermont. That's rad.
I tell you, it's crazy to be in Underhill, Vermont, which is really out there in the country, and to, you know, see these tall black guys at dreadlocks blowing in the snowstorms.
Right. I could tell from the footage that they're in the country.
Yeah.
They're not in downtown Burlington or anything like that. Yeah. That's
But it's great. Like, everybody in that town loves them, like their family to that town. And everybody in Vermont in general, like, they're just like, they're not as big as Phish, obviously, but, you know, they're very respected up there, like Phish. You know, people are proud. And their sons, you know, are very much Vermont musicians. Like, they were born and raised up there, and they play amazing music too.
Yeah. Yeah. They're kind of like skate punks, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
great kids. I met Bobby Jr. when I first moved to Vermont. He was one of the only black kids hanging out in the group of punk kids that I started hanging out with. You know, I was like I was 18. I didn't know his last name. I just knew him as Bobby. And he was funny, and, you know, he liked horror movies, so I would go horror movies with him and some other people. It wasn't until Jeff had me sit down with him to go interview Bobby that I was like, oh, you're Bobby Hackney? I didn't know that your last name was Hackney.
Nice. So so there is a connection there. That's cool. I was wondering if there. I mean, Vermont's not that populated, so
no, it's not. I mean, there's. Yeah.
I wondered if you had any connection with them previous to the film.
It for me. Like, just unknowingly, kind of hanging out with them. Yeah. The group of punk kids I hung out with, like, I only knew one of them really, and the other kids kind of always hung out with him. So I was always just like, oh, cool. Like, I have friends. But Jeff was the one. Jeff Hallett was the one. And I know I completely went off on a tangent, not finishing my South by Southwest story, but I'll go back to it. Jeff Hallett was the one he's my co-director on the film. I met him because a friend of mine was shooting a poppy punk music video for Jeff, and I had heard of Jeff because he went to my film school. He went when I graduated, and he also went before I started going to college, so he went a little bit before I started, and then started college again after I left. And I had heard of him, you know, especially being I'm more of a metalhead than a punker, I would hear, like, oh, Mark, you would love this guy. He's got tat sleeves. He's a metalhead. He was in a couple of these bands. I was like, oh, those bands, like, when I first moved to Vermont, I used to go see them. And they're like, yeah, he's making music videos. You should hook up with him. And I just never did until my friend asked me to come work on this music video. And it was some poppy punk music video. It was cute. But I was basically just the assistant camera / balloon boy. There was a scene where balloons are getting thrown at these punks that are playing their happy punk music. I'm just like chucking balloons at them. And I hit it off with Jeff on that shoot. Like, we both liked, you know, the same kind of movies, same kind of music. And he had heard that I was in documentaries, because I had previously, up until that point, was making for the past 3 years, a hip hop documentary. and it never got completed. But and even before that documentary, my first film was a hybrid. It was a mockumentary about how weird Vermont people are, because I was a New Yorker living in Vermont. I'm like, these people are fucking weird. Yeah.
So, don't New Yorkers go there to watch the leaves turn or something? Is that
yeah,
a thing?
Basically. I mean, yeah. The New Yorkers are the weird ones at the end of the day. But you know, I made this funny little doc, and it's you would laugh at it, Jeremy. I wear a No Effects shirt throughout the whole thing.
Nice.
but anyway, Jeff had heard, you know, oh, this kid knows documentaries. And so he started telling me about how he knows these guys who are in this brand called Lamb's Bread, but he just discovered, and he's like, they've been friends of mine for 25 years. You know, I've, you know, we're both musicians and kind of like lived in Vermont for the past 20 to 30 years. He's like, they're very close friends. And I just discovered from them that they were part of this punk band in the 70s called Death, and they're black and Detroit. And he gave me the whole rundown, and I was just like, yeah, whatever, man. I thought he was bullshitting me. Mm-hmm. You know, because like I'm from New York, so I had heard all the stories from New York, you know, mm-hmm. about punk. And I was like, man, I haven't heard anything about these guys. You know, I've heard of Pure Hell, but I haven't heard of these guys.
Yeah.
And so Jeff's like, no, let me send you a little synopsis of what I'm thinking. He wanted to do like a 25-minute PBS type doc is what he kept telling me. And I was just cringing at that, because I like to make docs that are like feature narratives. Like I want them to be real, but I also want them to feel beautiful and sound great. Like I don't want it to look like a fucking hospital visit. Like I want it to have art. And then he sent me the New York Times article, which had just come out around that time. And there were two tracks by the band that were online that I think Ben Blackwell put, or might've been someone else. But, I was like, just send me that stuff and I'll take a look at it. And at the time, like I was saying, I was trying to finish up this hip hop doc that was kind of going nowhere. And I realized, after that music video shoot, I was sitting in my office one day, a week later, I hadn't even looked at Jeff's email, 'cause I thought he was full of shit. And I was just like sitting in my office staring at the wall, really depressed that I just spent 3 years on this hip hop doc. And I'm just like, it's never going to get done. Like, my subjects are not cooperative at this point. They've been putting my life through hell. I'm out of money. My producer kind of abandoned me. I gotta do something to make me feel alive again. So like Jeff told me this was just a 25-minute doc, you know. Maybe that's going to make me happy to just work on this on a weekend. Jeff just wanted me to be a DP for it, too. He wasn't looking for a co-director at the time. DP / producer, I guess. And also somebody to guide him, because he didn't know docs. And I looked at his email and I read his synopsis, and then I read the New York Times article, and I was just like completely floored. It was like reading the greatest rock and roll story I hadn't heard before. And then I played Keep On Knocking was the first song I played, and I fell out of my seat. And I immediately called Jeff back, and I told him he was fucking crazy for wanting to do a shitty PBS, like, 25-minute thing. I'm like, dude, this is a fucking feature. Like, we got to go and start filming this now, because the world's going to start filming this soon. Mm-hmm. Like, we know these guys. We have direct access to them. Like, we got to go now while the iron's hot. He was like, really? You think this could be a feature? I was like, no, I know this could be a feature. This is way better than the hip hop doc that I was trying to focus on, and way better than the What State Is Vermont In, which was the Vermont documentary. He was like, okay. And it was like after a couple of shoots, like I started realizing, like, Jeff, you know, he didn't fully get the doc thing yet. And so I was kind of guiding him and helping him out a lot, to the point where I was like, you want to just like co-direct this thing? Mm-hmm. like we'll just do this together, because I'm kind of doing a lot of work here. basically directing some of this.
And he's like, you shot a lot of the footage too, right?
Yeah. I shot most of it. Yeah. Well, I don't know if any of Jeff's footage even made it into the film, because he shot Bobby Jr.'s original interview, but that's not in the film. Mm-hmm. That's in the deleted scene on the disc. And he shot another interview with a friend. But yeah, I don't know if any of the things, I think I was the one that shot everything except for in Los Angeles, we didn't have money to fly us out for Henry Rollins and Wayne Kramer. And so our producer, Scott Mosier, his friend or acquaintance, I don't know if he was a friend or if he was just a colleague, but Zach Kungston, I think is how you say his name, he shot those.
Yeah.
He's actually the sexy stud in Clerks 2, if you want to know who shot those.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, nice.
Nice. The one who's like, oh, cake.
Yeah, right.
Great. So he's a great guy. Keep in touch with him to this day. So.
Is the Wayne Kramer interview in special features, or is that just completely cut?
Oh, no, okay. That's out.
I'd like to see that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'll send you a link to. Jeff and I were really pissed that we had to cut that out.
Because
we knew how important Wayne Kramer was to their development as musicians.
The Detroit connection, MC5, obviously, it makes sense. So, yeah, how did that wind up getting cut? Like, why didn't it work?
It was just it was really hard because by the time we got Hollywood producers, which we can get into how that happened too. I originally was doing a lot. I was shooting it. I was directing it. I was helping come up with questions with Jeff. I was flying out to film people like Jello Biafra on my own. it wasn't easy work, but I was also trying to edit on top of that. And I had cut probably about 40 minutes, which is all of the deleted scenes you see on the disc. Most of the deleted scenes that you see on the DVD or Blu-ray, which, by the way, you can buy on my Etsy.
Everybody should go do that because seriously, listeners, if you can go buy the disc, because we'll talk about it later, but Mark hasn't seen hardly a fucking penny from this movie. So if you can help him out, man, it would be incredible. It's a great film, and all the special features sounds fucking incredible. So
we'll get into it too, but it is probably never going to be available again. Based on what we're dealing with now. So if you want to see it and you want to support the filmmaker and you want to just have a great piece of art to keep for life, there's nothing better than physical media.
For sure.
Yeah, it's ripped like crazy all over YouTube. You could go see it there. I could care less, but it would really help me out if you bought a physical. And I'm selling them pretty reasonable. There's guys on eBay selling it for $80, you know.
No shit.
I'm selling it high, in my opinion, a little high, but it's like $40. But I have to sell it that way because fucking eBay or Etsy take out like $10, you know?
Right. Well, plus all the special features and shit.
Yeah.
You can get that online.
Yeah. Yeah. And I trust me, I made sure we jam packed these suckers.
And you can't find it streaming anywhere. I hopped on Amazon because I was like, oh, I'll just go ahead and, even if I have to rent it, I'll rent it. Well, it says unavailable. Like, there's still a page there, but unavailable.
After LAFF, Drafthouse Films bought it. You know, at first I was a little weary because I was like, who are Drafthouse Films? I didn't even know about the theaters. You know, they were fairly new to me, at least at the time.
Sorry to interrupt. The production company or distribution company is tied to
the theaters.
Oh, shit. I didn't know that. I wasn't
sure.
Yeah.
So Tim League is this guy who made a lot of money working for the oil industry, I believe, out in California. And he used that money because he had a passion for cinema and film to open up Alamo Drafthouse Theaters, which we now know is really badass theaters where you can get food and they have a no talking policy, and they're amazing theaters. What he did was really great in terms of getting people excited about going to the theater again. Then, like a few years after the success of those theaters, he had about 17 theaters, I think, around the country by the time he ended up coming up with the idea of having a distribution company where they would buy films and distribute them. They didn't produce films to be made, but they would, you know, see that, oh, this little indie film's doing good. Let's do a deal with these filmmakers, put it out there for 10 years or whatever. They were the ones that had the best offer for us at LAFF. And so they bought our film. It was like a, it was a $50,000 deal for 10 years. And that barely put a dent in our debt. I think we probably had, by the end of the film, $200,000, maybe $250,000 in debt, you know, put into the film. So, you know, for $50,000, like, that really didn't do anything, but, you know, they took it and started working on the promotion for it and all this stuff. And while that was going on, we were playing film festivals. Now fast forward to the next year after Los Angeles Film Festival, Drafthouse owns our film, but they want to make a big announcement with it. They want to go out of the gates, you know, guns a-blazing. And Tim League owns Austin, Texas. Like, he owns it. He's the fucking mafia of Austin, Texas now. And so he was pissed off that it didn't play South by Southwest and have a world premiere. So he got in touch with the woman that was running it, and he had a coffee meeting with her. And he's like, why didn't this play South by Southwest? And she's like, she played dumb. She's like, I don't know. We'll play it this year, which is not normal. They don't like to have films that already had their big world premieres. So I'm not ashamed to say that, like, in a way, we cheated to get in the South by Southwest in 2013 by having Tim League basically be the strong arm to our movie.
Sure.
What I am proud of is we played there and we won the audience award for our category. And so that I was very proud of. And it had great screenings, sold out screenings. The band performed. It was great. I wasn't a huge fan of the festival, but it was a little too cluster fucky. But it was still great that they took our film and showed it and everything.
South by Southwest has gotten so fucking commercial, and
same thing as Sundance. Yeah.
Shitty. Like I remember when I was way more active in the music scene around 2000, like the year 2000, 2001 or so, you know, I always wanted to go to South by Southwest because it was still raw and cool. And now it's just so fucking
it's
commercial,
very corporate.
I don't want any part of it.
I mean, you know,
as an artist who's submitting things to it, just as an observer, I have no desire to be down there. It sounds too chaotic for me.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely like, the thing I didn't like was we were just a number when we showed up. They did not care for us at all.
That sucks.
And Drafthouse did. They treated us very well. They took us places. They treated us like kings. So I got to give them credit there. Drafthouse made the experience fun. The South by the Festival didn't. I was watching people like Rob Zombie be treated like a king, while other filmmakers like me and lesser filmmakers are just forgotten. It's like, yeah, we're playing your film. You should be happy enough. I didn't even get a swag bag. Not that that
Are
matters.
Are you fucking serious?
Yeah.
That
matters, but I mean, I would get from Tall Grass. I would get it from Hell's Half
Mile.
It's
the principle of the thing.
No, they gave me pamphlets.
was 2013 was the same year we screened it, right?
I think so. I was trying to remember when Tall Grass screened it. I think it was 2013.
I think so, because you were there with Worm, right?
Bowser. Yeah.
I
was a big supporter of that movie too.
Oh, that was great.
I could see at the time that all of this was happening. I started to understand filmmakers who had ins and filmmakers that were still struggling, and I had ins by that point. And so I tried to use all of my connections to get that film bought, because I thought Worm was one of the best, most revolutionary films I had seen in a long time.
Oh, for sure.
And I tried with Drafthouse, I tried with Mad Men Entertainment, I tried everywhere. And they would listen to me and they would watch it, but at the end of the day, none of them thought it was worth their time. I don't understand.
I don't get it. I mean, and then, you know, what, 10, 12 years later, that bullshit fucking Hardcore Harry or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Is a movie that's fucking so stupid.
Highly recommend everybody seek out the film Worm, W-O-R-M. It's directed by Andrew Bowser, who I forgot the character he plays, but he's very popular, viral character.
What is it?
I can Google it.
He wears the fedora. He's like the goth guy. What's fuck?
Yeah, he made a whole movie based on this character.
It starts with
Onyx. Onyx.
Onyx. Yeah. It's Onyx.
Onyx the fortuitous.
Fortuitous. Yeah. Onyx the fortuitous. That's it.
This is the guy who did the weird, like interviews, right?
Yeah, Arby's guy, the weird Arby's.
Fucking so hilarious.
So he shot Worm in Oklahoma, like Norman, Oklahoma, I think. And when we screened it, we thought he was like an Oklahoma guy, but he's from the East Coast. I think it Baltimore, Maryland, or something.
He's from Maryland. Near Baltimore.
Do you still talk to him? Are you guys still connected at all?
This is the thing, man. I just saw him last year, I think it was, maybe, or maybe it was the year before, at a festival that I'm on the board of, the Chattanooga Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And I see him occasionally at film festivals, and it's always the same thing. It's always him and I talking about how it fucking sucks what happened to film distribution and how we're never going to see any money for our movies.
Dude, that sucks.
Like just to hear him saying he's struggling, because he's been more successful than me since the
Onyx. He was on, what was he on?
He was on the Nerdist.
The Nerdist, that's what it was,
Which, by the way, our best director's commentary is through the Nerdist, and you can't hear it anymore. I have a copy of it. My dream is, if I ever get a re-release of the movie, I want to put it on there, because it's me and Jeff with Wayne Kramer watching the movie.
Oh, fuck.
And I didn't even know this. I feel like such an asshole, but Wayne hadn't seen the fucking film until that day.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
So you got a raw reaction from Wayne.
Yeah.
That's so fucking,
I didn't even
cool.
realize it until halfway into the movie. I'm like,
dude, that's fucking rad.
This motherfucker hasn't even seen the movie.
Wow. So we're getting off topic again, but the other filmmaker that was in town with a band called Death was Alex something. I don't remember his last name. He did the film A is for Alex, about his wife being pregnant, getting ready to have a baby, and had to leave Alex Orr. And he had to leave the film fest early because his son was going to appear in Too Many Cooks.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah.
You know what's funny is the alien abortion film I was telling you about earlier.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I don't even know if we have this on the podcast or if we were talking about it before we started recording. I produced a short sci-fi comedy about alien abortion, kind of making fun of the heartbeat bill. And the lead of that movie is the killer in Too Many Cooks.
Oh, yeah. Spoiler alert.
That's so fucking cool.
All right, that was it, right? Too Many Cooks was the guy keeps creeping up.
For sure.
Yeah, that's our boy, William Tokarski.
Alex Orr, who did A is for Alex, which is another great film. If you can find it, watch it. He had to leave early.
One thing that's been great about the film festivals, because there's a lot involved with film festivals, a lot of politics, and you know, I've got the things I hate about film festivals and things I love about them. And I really only keep in touch with the ones that I feel are down to earth and cool. And unfortunately, a lot of my favorites are gone now or have new management. But there are filmmakers I meet, like Andrew Bowser or like Jeff Marslet.
Oh, yeah. Jeff is fucking great.
You know, who I get to talk to one-on-one. I mean, I don't want to say too much, but like, we get to talk about our struggles, and it makes me realize I'm not alone in what I've been experiencing, that it sucks, and it's just like it's rigged against us all. Like, you know, it's a lot of luck in this business.
Yeah,
making it have a lot of luck.
Similar to music, I mean, there's 1,000 brilliant musicians out there that never see a fucking penny because they weren't lucky. Josh House treated you really well.
Yeah.
And then.
Well, you know, it was like this amazing honeymoon with them. I mean, it was just South by Southwest. They were great. You know, like South by Southwest, they don't fly feature filmmakers or put them up unless you're a name. Like they couldn't give two fucks about you. So, and also they let all of the lesser filmmakers know they got in at the last fucking minute. So everything's booked anyway. So I didn't even have a chance to like, mm-hmm. like most plane tickets were almost sold out and there was no place to stay. So I let our producers know, like, I really want to be there for this. It's South by Southwest. It's a big thing for me and Jeff. And I let Drafthouse know. And so Tim League, you know, the mensch that he is, he's like, stay in my attic, you know, and his attic isn't just a fucking attic. It's a movie theater. It's
right.
Like a big house. Yeah. And so we stayed at Tim League's house. He put us up. He was just the kindest, most welcoming dude. And like I said, they took us to barbecue joints. They took us to other events. Like it was great. They introduced us to filmmakers. You know, I got to meet the filmmakers behind Cheap Thrills, which ended up becoming one of my favorite films ever made. Met Jason Eisner behind Hobo with a Shotgun,
mm-hmm.
and his composer is now my composer, which is kind of cool. Nice. But anyway, it was great. And then after South by Southwest, you know, after they did their big announcement and it's all over the press that Drafthouse Films bought A Band Called Death, that was the beginning of like, they're going to promote this thing and get it out there and do a big release. And it was like basically a whole month that we were going to spend on this. They were going to like do a bunch of press, have us do a bunch of press, a lot of interviews with like MSNBC and shit, Huffington Post, stuff like that. Then they flew Jeff and I out to LA to spend like basically a week doing podcasts, like very popular podcasts, a bunch of other interviews. I did my first live AMA where we did it at the Silent Picture House in Los Angeles, which is a popular movie theater. It was all great. Like, it was awesome. And then shortly after that, they do the physical release and it was all like contained within a month. But then after that month, it was like, kind of forgot about our movie and it was all Act of Killing because that was the film that was going to get them the Oscar. And I understand because it's a better film and blah blah blah, but really like they just started focusing all of their attention to Act of Killing, and it was almost like they didn't even own our movie. It was just, it's already out, whatever. One thing that I didn't realize was a bad thing at the time was almost as soon as they got the film and when they did this big rollout, they immediately did a deal with Netflix where they gave Netflix a bunch of their movies. And so our film was on Netflix for a year, which sounds like it could be great. It was great for exposure, but unfortunately, like what Netflix does is they pay a small flat fee to be able to own your film for that year to show it. And then they don't pay you any residuals. Now, at the time, I know they don't like giving out numbers now, but again, our producer Scott Mosier had a lot of pull. He was helping us, or it was either him or the other producer that we had, was getting me numbers on how well it was doing on Netflix. And I heard within a month it was getting 500,000 views.
Shit.
And so yeah. 500,000 views.
That was
views
the first place I saw it, was on Netflix.
Where's my fucking money?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, it's getting all these views, and I'm being told, oh, you're never going to get money because they already paid for it. So that was kind of a shit way to roll out our film. We should have waited for Netflix. But that's just the way it worked for that particular thing. And then Drafthouse, like I said, kind of forgot about us for a while after Act of Killing came out. And none of that would really burden me that bad if I didn't learn later on that every penny that Drafthouse spent marketing our film and doing all of the physical media and everything, that was our debt. So we were an extra $100,000 in debt after the debt we already had.
As a music guy, that sounds like what happens to indie artists when they go to a major label, and the major label tax all of the fees onto them, and then they have to make it up on tour.
Yep.
Or they're fucked.
Yeah.
And
I didn't know that was the thing. Is that that's common in music and film?
Very common. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, for sure.
That's why
a lot of independent bands stay independent because they can make more money independent.
Yeah.
Right. They don't get as much distribution from you know, they don't get in Walmarts and shit like that, but they save so much money touring and on merch and shit like that because the major labels just fuck you over,
right?
Try and squeeze every penny out of you.
And some of these distribution companies now will be up front and say, like, do you want us to deal with this or do you want to deal with it? But not all of them do that.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's
I didn't have the option with Drafthouse. I just assumed whatever they're doing is their debt, not our debt.
Right.
I will say, like, our film has made way over whatever our debt was, but no matter what, the quarterly reports, Hollywood accounting, always said that the film was in the red. And for all I know, that might not have all been Drafthouse's fault. Because basically what happened when Jeff and I ended up teaming up with these Hollywood producers, and we didn't realize it was happening because we were just so... We needed help. Like, there was a certain point when Jeff and I were on our own and we just needed somebody to help us because Jeff was going through a divorce because of the movie.
Oh, shit.
I was about to file for bankruptcy. Things were dire. And Jeff and I had a phone conversation one day, you know, almost a year into making the movie, where we just talked about either quitting the film or making it like a 10-year thing, like Hoop Dreams. Like, we can't keep doing this to ourselves. We're going to die making this. And it was a very depressing phone call to make. And then almost an hour or two after that, a friend of mine who was obsessed with Twitter at the time and obsessed with the View Askew people, like Kevin Smith and Scott Mosier, like he was following all those people on Twitter at the time. He just hit me up. He's like, dude, how come you didn't tell me Scott Mosier and Kevin Smith were all about your movie, blah, blah, blah. I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? How do they even know about my movie? And apparently they saw a trailer that I had cut that I put online earlier in the year, because earlier in the year, this musician named Mos Def was going around saying he was doing a doc on these guys, and he wasn't. He was lying, and he was doing all these interviews. And I was like, we got to make a trailer now to show people that we're making this movie, not him. And so that trailer somehow got to Scott, and he also got an album by somebody of the band's music, and he listened to the music. He's like, I want to see this doc. Where is it? And he was tweeting about it. And so I asked my friend Nate, because I wasn't on Twitter, I was like, can you send him a message, a private message, and give him my email address and tell him to contact me? I would love to talk to him as soon as possible. And that same fucking night that I had the phone conversation with Jeff about quitting the film or spending 10 years making it, we were on a phone with Scott talking about the film and the possibilities of teaming up.
Wow.
And shortly,
I'm a huge fan of the New Jersey trilogy.
Yeah,
I could really give a shit less about his films after that. I mean, Red State's good.
Yeah, I like Red State.
I mean, Tusk is weird as fuck, but kind of good. But really, for me, it's the New Jersey.
We're not going to talk about Yoga Hosers.
That's no, we don't need to talk about Yoga Hosers. But yeah, no, I was a fan. I had my favorites. I love Clerks. I really love Clerks 2.
Oh, yeah.
I think Clerks 2 is my favorite. I love Dogma.
Yes. Which is still out of print, isn't it?
He's getting it back.
I've got it on VHS in my house.
He just won finally because Harvey's in prison and everything.
Right, yeah.
I forgot about Dogma. So the New Jersey trilogy and Dogma are my
favorite. Quadrilogy.
Not only did I love this guy's movies, but I mean, to have Scott Mosier, who's the guy that helped him make these, be excited about working with us, like, that just blew me away. I mean, this is a guy that I grew up idolizing, you know, who he did it the independent way, and
Snowball.
Snowball. He's very much these guys are very much the reason why Sundance is as big as it is today.
Right.
And so I was excited. I was like, man, but I told Jeff at the time, I said, I before that first phone call with Scott, because it was very nerve-wracking. It was like, you know, we just talked about quitting the film. Now we're talking with a Hollywood producer. And on the same day, I told Jeff, I said, listen, man. He's like, I've spent years studying Hollywood, you know, watching behind-the-scenes shit. I'm like, we got to be careful. Like, even though this is Scott Mosier, and he's like, Jeff didn't even know who he was. Like, I had to kind of get him up to speed. And, like, he produced Clerks. He's this indie He's kind of like what I would like to call a celebrity producer, a producer you know by look and by voice, because Smodcast was really big too. And so I was like, listen, like, we don't know this guy. He seems down to earth, and it's great he wants to talk to us, but we got to be cautious. We can't trust anybody out there in Hollywood. Like, we got to have our guards up. And Jeff's like, okay, okay. And like, we both like had this agreement. Like, we're gonna tread lightly. We're gonna send NDAs if he wants to see footage. He has to sign an NDA. We're not gonna send him anything without an NDA. We did that. After a phone conversation, Scott told us, he's like, listen, guys, he's like, I'm trying to get away from the whole view askew thing. I'm trying to do my own thing. I produced a couple of docs already. He's like, my dream has been to like just produce a rock and roll doc, and this is right up my alley, blah, blah, blah. And we're like, great. And he's like, do you have any footage edited? And I was like, I have 40 minutes cut. I was like, we could send you an NDA and I'll ship you out the hard drive. And that's what we did. And he saw it and he got back to us like a week later. He's like, guys, this is great. This footage looks way better than most of the doc stuff I see. He's like, it's very cinematic. Like, you did a great job lighting it, Mark. And blah, blah, blah. And he's like, listen, like, I want to work with you guys. I want to help you finish this. I was like, great. And so then that conversation went into, I've got these friends from this company called Haven Entertainment, Kevin Mann and Matthew Pernicerio. And he's like, I would like to bring them on board, because he's like, you know, producers have different levels. He's like, I'm like the Rolodex producer who's been through it all. I know everybody and I know how it should go. But he's like, I'm not the business producer. He's like, these guys deal with business. They will find us finishing funds to finish this movie. And, you know, they will deal with all the business stuff. I'm like, okay, let's have a conversation with them. And we had a conversation with them. And I really like Kevin Mann. He seemed very down to earth and cool. Matthew, on the other hand, seemed very conceited and full of himself and a typical Hollywood guy. And I could tell right off the bat I was going to have issues with him. But at the same time, like, we were desperate. And these guys are they're telling us they could give us the world, you know? They're like, we could find the money for this. And, you know, Mark, do you want to edit still? And I'm like, fuck no. If you could find the money, let's get an editor.
Right.
I'm already burnt out on this, like, doing everything I'm doing. And so they're okay. Like, Scott's got this editor he likes to use. He was a great editor for us. He did the Ozzy Osbourne documentary, and so I knew he could deal with all the different codecs and everything, because we shot on so many different formats, from film to digital to
16 millimeter, 13 millimeter,
8 millimeter,
32. I mean,
eight millimeter film for the film parts, and then we shot mini DV, and we also shot HVX 200. We shot with P2 cards in 1080 HD, and then also Canon. We shot SD cards. shot that in 1080. So it was like a very diverse mix. I think I even shot some stuff on VHS.
Oh, nice.
Rich Fox. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great editor. He really did a great job, and it was easy to give him notes and have him take our notes and turn them into the movie that it is today. While all of this is going on, this is where my memory is very vague and very cloudy. And also, I don't really have a lot of contracts to have a paper trail. But somewhere along this time, we all had to sign a contract. Basically, when I started working on the film, I was a for hire for Jeff's company. He had to create a contract between him and the band, because the band wouldn't let anybody film them unless they signed a contract saying the band got 50% or whatever, which is a fucking no-no in filmmaking. Like, I was so angry at Jeff when I saw that he had a contract between him and the band saying they're getting 50% of whatever the film makes. I'm like, Jeff, the fucking film is barely going to make anything. We need to make some money on this. So that was the first bad thing that happened with the film. And then I came on as like a for hire for Jeff's company. And so Jeff's 50% is now 25% between me and Jeff. And then the band gets the other 50%. And then we had these Hollywood producers come on board. And so then this pie is now getting sliced between us and these three other producers. somewhere in the mix, I don't know when it happened, and we don't have a contract for this, but Matthew Pernicerio, the guy I didn't get along with, created an LLC for the film, which is what you do when you make a film, usually create an LLC for the film itself. Mm-hmm. Jeff and I were using Jeff's company at the beginning, which he still uses to this day. Scott had his own company. But Matthew created an LLC just for the film, and it was only under his name, to my knowledge.
Oh, fuck.
And so that's where things get fucked up, because that's basically where he stole the film from us, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Because we're not part of that LLC. We never have to sign anything for that LLC,
right?
As far as I know. We don't ever see contracts related to the LLC. It's called Keep On Knocking LLC. You'll see it at the ending of the movie. So that was the beginning of where Jeff and I think got screwed. We had an entertainment lawyer that we used who was Jeff's friend, who was a music attorney. I don't think he understood film at all, and I think that was another mistake. We should have tried to find an actual film attorney. I don't think this guy fought hard enough for us. I remember one of our first conversations with Scott, I think with just Scott, not with these other guys on the phone, but it was like, I told Jeff, I was like, we need to bring up gross and net, because I know if we don't make gross, we're never going to see a penny. And so we brought that up with Scott, and Scott's like, well, he's like, most people in this business, they don't do gross. Like, it's going to be net. I'm sorry. Like we could try for gross, but everyone's going to say no. And it's like, everyone does net anyway. And he just like assured us that that was normal. And I don't even know why we even agreed. Like, I should have just like stood my ground and said, no, no, we're only doing this for gross. Fuck that. Mm-hmm. But eventually Matt found the money to help finish the film. He found it from his friend, Jerry Farrar, who was Turtle on the show Entourage.
Yeah, I saw that on IMDb. I thought that was interesting. Yeah.
Literally like went up to him on set of, I think, Entourage, and showed him the trailer I cut and told him our predicament. And he was like, say no more. And he wrote a check, and we had finishing funds. He's another part of the reason why I think we haven't seen money. It's like every time I would bring up money, Matt would always be like, well, Jerry's got to get paid back first. Like, all right, great. I hope he's definitely gotten paid back by this fucking point, because the film's made over its budget. Right. Yeah, that was always his excuse to us. Go pay back, Jerry. I'm like, all right, whatever. By the way, Jerry Farrar was a fucking asshole to us out when we met him in California. I'm not at all surprised. Yeah, I was meeting these producers.
One of the guys on Entourage wasn't cool.
I mean, hey, I'm very appreciative of him giving money to the film. But at the end of the day, like, I went out to LA to meet these guys in person for the first time. I brought each one of them like $100 to $200 swag bags up filled with Vermont goodies, maple syrup, you know, chocolates, cheeses, to thank them all for helping us make the film. And Jerry just fucking took it and chucked it behind him. He couldn't care less. And he completely ignored us the entire time, never acknowledged us. And as far as I know, like every podcast he's been on that I've heard, at least, he always only mentions Matthew or Scott. He never mentions us. It's like we never existed and we're never a part of the film. So I could see what the dynamic was making this film, where Matt and Scott were always the ones out in California, you know, sitting with the editor, sitting with the sound mixer. So, you know, to Jerry's eyes, they were the ones that made the film. But yeah, he was a real dick when we met him in person. Anyway,
not shocked at all.
No, man. Yeah.
I tell you,
I thought you were going to say the turtle was cool, and I was going to be like, now that's surprising.
The one, I mean, Scott was always down to earth with us, and Kevin Mann was always down to earth with us.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew, I could tell throughout the whole experience, was just bullshitting us. And I ended up having a fight with him at the end of the film when he was submitting it to South by Southwest. He changed the name of our film on us without giving us a warning. It was originally called Where Do We Go From Here, which was the name of one of their songs.
Yeah.
And I had spent, you know, months designing artwork with a famous comic book artist, M. Wartola, I think is his name. And you know, you could see it in the trailer that I cut, the original trailer. And, you know, we had business cards, we made posters, like a whole thing. Like we lived with that name for 3 years, I think. And then at the very end, when he's filling out the form for South by Southwest, he's like, okay, I'm filling out the form and I'm changing the name to a band called Death. And everybody was always like, yes. But to me, like, I always take shit like that more personal because these are my babies, and you don't just fucking take my baby and change the fucking name of my baby without giving me.
At the very least, a conversation you have. Like, at the very least. Yeah.
And so, you know, I got into an argument with him on the phone, one of our weekly phone conversations where we're all, you know, calling in. And Scott's like, guys, calm down, calm down. He's like, listen, he's like, let's take a week. Mark and Jeff, you know, see if you can find a different name, and, you know, we'll touch base a week from now. And if that name's not any better than a band called Death, we'll go with a band called Death. I'm like, all right, fine, whatever. They really didn't like Where Do We Go From Here. So me and Jeff spent a week trying to come up with different names. Had some really funny shit. Like one of them was White Boy Music.
That's awesome. Yeah, I like that.
You know, like a lot of the names we came up with were just jabs at like stupid titles because I thought A Band Called Death was such a dumb title. Mm. You know, like what are you force feeding the audience with the fucking name of the movie?
right.
And so anyway, like Jeff and I did a poll online. Scott saw that. He got pissed off at that. He's like, you guys can't be doing polls for this. I'm like, all right, fine. Sorry. And then one day I had a conversation with my dad. He was, you know, he was 80 year old dude, you know, old timer conservative. And he was like, Mark, I would never go see a movie called A Band Called Death. And I'm like, and I just started thinking about how turned off my dad was. I was like, well, I'm not making this film for punk rockers or heavy metal guys or anything. Mm. I'm making this for the world. Like I want the world to discover these guys. And I don't want the name, ironically, just like the band, I don't want the name to turn people away. That's the last thing I want to do because that happened once already to these guys.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
And it's like I told you at the beginning of the podcast, my wife told me she would have never even considered watching it if I hadn't made her.
Yeah,
she was like, I saw the title. It didn't really interest me, and then after we watched it, she was like, "That was an awesome movie."
Yeah, no,
like, it never would have watched it otherwise.
It's like, one of those things, like they're gonna love it if they see it, but if they see that title, how do we get them in the theater? And so that was like a light bulb up went up in my head. I was like, okay, my dad's got a point. And then I started thinking about how for years now we were dealing with the death metal fans that are fans of Schuldner's band. They fucking hated us. Like every and it wasn't even their fault. It was the manager's fault. The guy that was running the business for that band was always talking shit about us. Like these fucking guys, blah blah blah. Our death is the real death, and blah blah blah. And it was like he was not the first ones. Yeah, well, he really wasn't making it easy for us, and so fans were always sending us hate mail, and then eventually this motherfucker, this manager, got our page taken down on Facebook right when we had 20,000 followers, and I think he did the same for the band too. What that motherfucker didn't realize was that the band copyrighted their name in the 70s. And so they sent their lawyers after him and got his page taken down. And next thing you know, he was like, oh, sorry, you know, misunderstanding. and he's left us alone ever since. But I don't even know if that guy is still alive. but yeah, I mean, that was a fucking struggle having our page taken down right when it was about to get released, you know?
Jesus,
like we needed those followers to help promote
because
so grassroots. Right. And what a petty thing to get pissed off about, you know?
Right.
Like there can be two bands called Death Asshole.
Right.
Which, you know, this is very much the reason why the band always goes by like Death from Detroit or something on their page. Like they don't just say Death. And obviously ours is A Band Called Death, you know, it's the title of the movie. So I think when our lawyers got in touch with his lawyers, like that was all talked about.
Because there's, you know, some like punk rock elite who claim that the documentary says that Death is the first black punk rock band.
And it doesn't.
It doesn't. That's what I was going to say. It doesn't. Now, the dude on Howard Stern calls him a punk rock band or whatever, but the documentary never says it. And the Hackneys never say it.
No,
they are a garage rock band from Detroit. And that's what they did.
So, somebody calls them proto-punk. I think it's like Elijah Wood or somebody calls them proto-punk, but like,
No, they were just playing rock and roll. That's exactly what they consider themselves, rock and roll. Anyone saying that somebody says that Death is the first black punk rock band doesn't know what the fuck they're talking about, because nobody fucking says that on the documentary.
They never claimed it.
Never claims that. And it causes strife where there doesn't need to be. And Kenny from Pure Hell being pissed off about it. Like, nobody in the documentary says it, man.
You
still can do that. Like,
I've always tried to be as transparent as the filmmaker of that film. So when I see that stuff, you'll notice me comment sometimes on Kenny's posts. Like, I'll get into it. And I like have to correct people. I'm like, listen, like we just said, nowhere in the fucking film do we say that. People see the poster and they get pissed off. It's like, listen, guys, I don't have it behind me, but the reason why the poster says before there was punk, there was a band called Death, because that's what the fucking New York Times article said.
Right. Yeah.
That's where we got that tagline. And it is kind of factual because people weren't using the term punk back then.
Right.
And they were before that.
The MC5 wasn't a punk rock band either.
Yeah.
Right. Well, so, and the term proto-punk, I mean, they became proto-punk retroactively.
Right.
After punk became a thing.
All of this shit is why I really wish our Wayne Kramer interview was in the film. I'm really pissed that it got cut out. As far as I know, it got cut out, if my memory serves me correct, because our producers were trying to say it just wasn't fitting with the rest of the narrative. And that could be very true. But if you watch the interview, I see a couple of parts where he's talking about David that I feel like we could have fit it into the David Hackney section. He talks about how David was the real deal. I can't wait for you guys to see that deleted scene, because he's like, he was better than Santana, he was better than Clapton, he was like, he was the real deal, and he's like, he just didn't play at the right place at the right time.
We'll see it in the director's cut.
I wouldn't mind throwing it into the film and having a director's cut.
Yeah.
He needed to be in the film. It's really fucked up that Wayne Kramer's not in the film. And so much anger out there is because we left out the MC5. Like, you never mentioned the MC5. And like, we have their record shown on camera. And I think the guys might have mentioned it, but it's like, it is brief and it probably should have been in there more. But it's just like, it's so hard when you're trying to get the whole story in, you know.
So is there any legal reasons you can't show those special features right now?
No. I mean, they're on the DVDs and Blu-rays. I post them every now and then, like for Black History Month on Threads. I've been posting some links.
Oh, nice.
Every February I do like, even though the film is painful to me to think about these days. I do, like, for Black History Month, I'll just put some treats out.
Yeah,
you know, try to get people talking about it again.
So the producers chose to cut Wayne Kramer and the MC5, but they chose to leave in Kid Rock.
Two times.
Were you there for interviewing Kid Rock?
I interviewed.
And do you
Kid
regret
Rock.
I'm not so sorry. Him in the face?
So no, I'm actually happy you brought this up, because I love telling this story. Because there was a guy in Boston at Boston Underground Film Festival that brought up Kid Rock, and this is one of my favorite moments. Let me see if I could retell it the way I told it there. But he was a little person in a wheelchair, so he had some disabilities, but he was being an asshole to me. He's like, why the fuck was Elijah Wood and Kid Rock in a punk rock document?
Wait, Elijah Wood is fucking cool.
Anyway, I told him what I tell everybody. When Jeff and I were making this film, we knew that because we were grassroots, we had to get some names in the film. I told Jeff, the only way I want names in the film is if they have a connection to the band's story. They have to be people who talked about the band publicly, who have expressed that they're fans, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, if they don't even know about the band, I don't want them in the film. So we had our list based on research. Everyone you see in the film had mentioned the band somewhere. you know, Kid Rock or not, Elijah Wood had heard about it through the grapevine and got a copy of the 45, and he was a DJ at the time and he was spinning it at mm-hmm. clubs. You know, Kid Rock heard about it through his friend, just like you hear in the movie, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, plus the Detroit connection, too.
Well, that, and that was the other thing I told Jeff and the producers. Once the producers came on board, I told them this idea. I was like, we need these, we need names. Like, mm-hmm. we need, I'm responsible for having the celebrities in the film that everybody bitches about who are like, there's too many fucking celebrities in the film. The celebrities are literally in the film for less than a fucking minute.
So right. Like, yeah.
They're barely in the film. But I did it because I knew that we needed them to help get the word out about the mm-hmm. film, because we're grassroots. There's no fucking way anyone's going to care about this film unless one of their favorite celebrities is in the film. Mm-hmm, right. But I wanted that connection. I wanted them to have a connection to the story. And also I wanted Detroit connections as much as possible. So mm-hmm. we had a huge list of people from Detroit, and Eminem was at the top of it. And I was like, I really want Eminem because I want to have somebody from the hip hop side of the world mm-hmm. represent. Yeah. You know,
yeah.
And so we weren't sure about him if he knew of the band, but we reached out to his reps and never heard back. So it was kind of a no. Kid Rock was, I think, Matt's idea. Okay. I think Matt
tracks.
I think Matt had heard, or maybe it was Jeff that had heard that Kid Rock was talking about the band. And so he was kind of like my backup, you know, like, mm-hmm. okay, if we can't get Eminem, like, let's do Kid Rock. You gotta remember at the time too, like, Kid Rock had his issues, but he wasn't as bad as he is today. And hey, I say this as somebody who like listened to his music when I was younger. You know, it was fun music to listen to.
Sure.
I just don't agree with his politics.
Yeah. No, I was just giving you shit.
About
being so close to him and not punching him. No, is there some regret there?
No, this is what I'll say about him. Everyone we interviewed was great to me and treated mm-hmm. me great. Kid Rock literally was in the middle of record. Like, I was having trouble finding his recording studio because it was in this like warehouse type area out in the country of Michigan. Mm-hmm. you know, kind of like where you'd store shit, you know, if you were moving.
Right, yeah.
And he had, like, had a studio. So, like, it was so inconspicuous. And I was having trouble finding it. And I finally go past the one building that kind of has cars parked in front of it. And I hear coming from inside, my name is Ken. And so he was doing a updated version of that song.
Nice.
And I'll say, like, he gave me more than the time that he had allotted to us. Like, you know, we had an hour, but he gave me more. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. after the interview, like, he was like, is there anything else you need? I was like, nah, man. He's like, do you want some beer? And he had his own, like, it's called badass beer that he brewed, I guess. And I was like, I was literally about to go back to the airport to fly back home, but I was like, I'll take your beer, sure. So I had my friend drive me to the airport because my friend came out with me for that shoot. Uh-huh. And I just drank like a couple of cans. I have a picture of me chugging a badass beer. But you know, I left the rest of the beer in the back of the rental, so the rental company has it now. But I mean, he couldn't have been more of a sweetheart to me at the time. You know, he wasn't mean, wasn't rude, and had nothing but praises for the band, and love for the band, and that's all that mattered to me at the time. Again,
for sure,
there wasn't a lot of what he ended up doing later on. And because of that, like, I don't really have regrets. Like it's a bummer that he is the way he is now.
But I
have like no regrets for asking him to be in it, because he was in it for all the right reasons at that time. And I told that kid, the young, not young, he was probably like 40s, but little person in a wheelchair, he was like such a dick when I was on stage in front of this whole audience at Boston Underground. And so I told the whole story about my plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end I said, and what's more punk rock, me putting who you want in the movie or me putting in who I want in my movie?
Right.
So
yeah,
you know, I actually cursed too. I was like, me putting in who you want or me putting in who the fuck I want?
Right.
And like, everybody's like, ah! You know, it's unfortunate that now, like, seeing the movie today, it's like a different feeling. But
well, and when Kid Rock, when I saw Kid Rock in it, he didn't seem out of place, especially for the context of the time. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I get it. He's a Detroit musician. Yeah. They're Detroit music. There's the connection.
Yeah.
Like people from, you know, the Motor City and, talking about other musicians from the Motor City. It makes sense.
For sure. Totally.
It didn't feel weird.
And, you know,
other than just Kid Rock is just weird. But, you know,
I never wanted. I tried with my documentaries. I try not to make anything that would with the doc stuff, at least not with my narratives, because then, as you know, with the alien ass rape movie, but like
that movie called? I gotta look that thing up.
It's called Fetal Position.
I'm googling it right now.
Yeah. Definitely check out Fetal Position. But no, with at least with the docs that I've been making, they've been very family centric. You know, like they're not, sure. they're not political by nature. And so I didn't want to put my own politics into either of them. I tried to stay out of it. I just tried to tell the family story that needed to be told. And so because of that, like with a band called Death, you'll see people like Kid Rock mixed with, you know,
Love and
yeah, exactly.
And shit like that. Yeah,
like I had no, I had
it,
no...
it totally makes sense. I don't want you to think I was questioning your
it's definitely
choices. It's just funny. You know,
what I'll say, the funniest thing is, minus the little guy in the wheelchair, the one I get the most shit for, the two I get the most shit for are not Kid Rock, it's Henry Rollins and Elijah Wood.
Why?
Really? I get the most shit for those two guys. Like, first, like, people just don't understand that Elijah Wood's really into the music scene.
Yeah, no. He's fucking cool.
Like, I think a lot of punk rockers are just like, ah, fucking Frodo Baggins. What the hell does he know?
Maybe you have to be from the Midwest or something, or spent time, because he's from Des Moines, and he would DJ a lot in Kansas City. Like, that's just a thing that I feel like Midwesterners know is, Elijah Wood really likes music.
Yeah, it's so weird how he gets a lot of flack. And then Henry Rollins, I kind of understand, because Henry Rollins is in every documentary.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, like, I can kind of get people are burnt out on hearing him talk.
You know, but the only thing that a band called Death is really missing is Ian McKay.
His
beanie.
That's
the only, like, there's
a
no
whole,
Ian
he has
McKay,
a whole drawer full
and
of
and there's
them.
No red beanie.
So yeah. I want to say better. So when it came to any music history, that was all, like, I always looked to Jeff, because I was not a music historian. I barely knew anything about the punk rock world. I was simply a filmmaker. Jeff was an older dude. He'd been in punk bands. He'd been in metal bands. I learned about the Bad Brains through Jeff. I didn't even know about that. I saw the logo and everything at the time, but I didn't know anything about him. Jeff had those people on his list. And I think we reached out, and I just don't think it ever worked out for whatever reason. Ian McKay is in the doc I'm currently editing now.
Is he wearing his red beanie?
Yeah, I think so. I think he is.
Of course he is. He has a drawer full of them. He's got to work his way through them.
But Jeff was very much, like, helpful in that respect. Like, I learned a lot about music history through Jeff. And so it was a learning experience for me while we were making the film. And I think me not knowing anything about that also helped make the film better, too, because I was focused on the family and less on the music. And Jeff was always kind of focused on the music side of things. And then we kind of balanced it out between the two of us. You know who my first celebrity interview was for the film was Jello, and I did that on my own. That was before we had Hollywood producers.
How'd you get a hold of him? How did that work?
I think Jeff just got in touch with, what's the company that he runs?
Alternative Tentacles.
Alternative Tentacles, yeah.
Okay.
Jeff got in touch with one of the guys that runs that, and he got us in touch with Jello, but boy, was that a hard interview for me, because I had to fly out to San Francisco, and then I literally, it felt like I flew in, and I only had a certain amount of time to film him, and then I had to fly back, because we were using our own money, and we were broke. And it was just me and a cam. Oh, sorry, what?
No. Go ahead, continue.
It was just me with a backpack with a camera, you know, big camera. and big lights, because back then we didn't have LEDs. I had these like tungsten type lights, and you know, stands and a big old tripod bag. I spent the night, I think I had 2 days maybe there, spent the night at my friend's studio, which was very small because you can't afford anything big in that city,
right?
In San Francisco. And so I had the next day to film scenery. And then at night, sometime towards the night, Jello was going to let us know the address to come to. And so, yeah. And so I'm going all over San Francisco filming as much B-roll that represents San Francisco without knowing how far away he's going to be.
Right.
And I had my friend's boyfriend with me holding the tripod bag. And we're getting great shots of San Francisco, but then finally I get the address and I'm like, shit, we got to go. Like, he's really far away.
Yeah.
And you know, it was basically like a series of taking buses and everything. And so me and this kid that I was with, we ran from this coffee place we were just getting coffee at to get to where Jello was. And then by the time we got to where Jello was, the kid's like, oh shit, I forgot the tripod.
No.
God.
And so like I'm like, God damn it. I'm like, all right, you go back, get the fucking tripod. I'm gonna go shoot the fucking interview. No matter how I figure it out, I'll figure it out. Yeah.
Stack of books.
Yeah, yeah. And so I had the taxi drop me off where his house was supposed to be. And it's just like a series of like brownstones. And I couldn't tell which was his house because none of them had numbers on them.
Oh Jesus.
And I'm walking up and down like, Jesus, like every one of these is just like a rich motherfucker that I don't know if it's him or not.
Right.
And finally I'm like, you know what? He's probably living in that one brownstone and it's got like no lights on. It's like completely dark. And so I go up there and I knock on the door and I hear him in the background in the distance yelling, hold on a second. He finally opens the door. He's wearing like skinny jeans with like snowman socks, little snowmen on his socks with shiny red snakeskin shoes. And he's got a tight T-shirt that you see in the interview that's got an album on it, like an obscure album. And he's like, he looks at me and goes, he just looks at me and goes, "You're late." I'm like, "Yeah, no, I'm sorry, man. I had an issue getting here with the taxi, blah blah blah, and I forgot my tripod." he's like, "Whatever." He's like, "I got to make a phone call." He's like, "Come inside and find out where you want to film." So I'm walking around and he's just like having me roam around his house. His house literally has records stacked to the ceiling everywhere.
Jeez.
It was fucking amazing. Like, the guy is a true record collector. Like, he just loves music. Every fucking genre you could think of, he's got it. Most obscure stuff. Apparently he has like the Death 45 somewhere there, but he couldn't find it. But he was like, and I asked him before he got on the phone call, I'm like, "Do you have a ladder? Because I forgot my tripod. I really need something to rest my camera on." And he's like, "All right, hold on a second." He brought like a little step ladder. I'm like, "All right, that's good." And I'm like, "Do you have something I could rest underneath it so that the camera points up?" And he's like, "Here you go." And he gives me one of those T-shirts that he's wearing. He's like, "Take it away." So I took the T-shirt. I put the T-shirt underneath the camera. And like, this is why the shot looks like shit. There's like a little lens flare by his head. It's like, I was like literally working with just me and like being nervous and like, you know, first celebrity for this film I'm interviewing and I might not have known punk rock, but I did love the Dead Kennedys. Like, I loved a lot of their music. Like, to me, like, they were ADHD music, which is what I am. Like, I'm just filled with like hyperactivity. And so like, I was very nervous to be there. And he's like having some weird conversation on the phone. It almost sounded like talking to an ex-wife or something. I was like, boy, this is making me so nervous. But you know, he sat down, he did the interview and he was great. He gave me more than I needed. And he walked me through an entire history of records. And there's on the deleted scene on the disc, he talks even more about those records. He introduced me to like an Ike and Tina album that I never heard of before, and I'm a big fan of their music back when they were doing it together. So it was great. And then he offered to drive me down the hill to go back to the bus to go back to the kid's apartment. The kid never finding the tripod, but it was too late. But yeah, and one last thing Jello said was, it's like, get those Ralph Francis boys to get in touch with me. Oh, that was funny. His sports car was like held together with duct tape. It was like an old 80s sports car.
Nice.
But it was, quite the experience. It was exactly what you would expect from a Jello experience.
It's not an act he's putting on.
No, not at all.
How'd you get hooked up with Drag City? Did you just reach out, or was that through Ruff Francis, or how'd that work?
Drag City, they were the ones that put out the Death album, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My memory is so cloudy at this point. So Drag City, because they had put the album out by then, and so we knew we needed to talk to them about getting their side of the story, and they gave us the guy that we interviewed, who I think was their PR person, maybe.
Okay.
Or maybe he worked. I don't know exactly what his position was. I can't remember. Like my memory's so foggy on him.
Yeah.
But he gave us a lot about how Drag City found them, basically through, as you know in the movie, through not Ben Blackwell, but what's his name? I'm so sorry, dude.
No worry.
Cole Manis. Why am I forgetting your first name, dude? He's very important to the story because he's the one that got the album out, the 45 out there. Robert Colmanis. Very important piece to this story, and he's even mentioned at the African American History Museum at the Smithsonian along with the 45. Yeah, he donated the 45 to them, and
that's so cool.
So he's in the film, like we interviewed him. Mm-hmm. But I think it was through him that we got in touch with Drag City, actually.
Okay. Awesome.
And so we went to Chicago, interviewed him there, I think, and we interviewed Drag City there. Yeah, the whole filming process was just nuts leading up to the Hollywood producers because it was literally just Jeff and I just doing everything off credit card and out of pocket. And that was part of the reason why the marriage was ending with Jeff.
That's rough.
Have a great night, guys. It's been
Thank you.
Really helpful talking about all this.
Good, man. Yeah. I'm glad.
Yeah.
Love to see you, buddy.
Bye-bye.
Take it easy.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye. All right. Yeah, once again, I want to thank Mark for being here tonight. This is the first time we've actually had the director of a film that we're reviewing on the podcast where we're reviewing it. And now, I guess we will go ahead. Should we go directly into positives and negatives?
Sure. Okay. Let's do that.
Okay. For me, I'll start out with the negatives. Fuck the film industry in general. You just heard Mark talk about how easy it is to get screwed over in that industry. So that's my negative, is fuck the film industry. And I'm really disappointed in Scott Mosier right now. Come on, man. Come on. I grew up loving you, man.
Yeah, what the fuck, Snowball? What the fuck?
Yeah. What the fuck, man?
That fucking sucks, dude. It's such a bummer. When I rewatched it, that's when I remembered Scott Mosier was a producer. And I was really excited to ask about like how he got involved and how Mosier became a producer, and I was ready to fanboy out and talk about how much I love the New Jersey trilogy and Dogma
quadrilogy
man, it just kind of shit the bed for me. Obviously not Mark's fault, he got fucked over more than anybody, but it just sucks. Never meet your heroes, there are no heroes, whatever you want to say. It's just a fucking bummer, man. The amount of time, effort, and passion that he put into not just a band called Death, but his other projects too, and to just be fucked over, man. It sucks. And, I'm not nearly as familiar with the film industry as I am with music. But it seems like it's not any different. If you're an artist, you're going to get fucked. And that really, really sucks.
Mm-hmm. And nobody appreciates art or the humanities in general. People don't value it.
No.
People just think that
it's
you should commodity. Just...
It's commodified now.
Right. Right. And you think like, why don't we value this stuff? Could you imagine a world that didn't have music and film and art and... fucking like actual good food. And yes, I do consider chefs to be artists, so I'm throwing them in there too. Can imagine that fucking world, man, without books, without comics, without Video games. I mean, Jesus. Yeah, video games. I mean,
also what a fucking horrible world. An exploited class are video game developers.
Okay, that's enough of our ranting for now. We reserve the right to rant about it later if we should decide. My last negative is, I know it makes sense in the film, and I know we talked about it, but Kid Rock. Sorry. It's Kid Rock. I know this is before we knew he was as crazy as he is. This is a long time ago. This is 15 years ago, Kid Rock. But yeah, it's still Kid Rock. It makes sense because he's from Detroit.
Sure.
It doesn't stick out in the film. If you don't know who he is or are unfamiliar with his current situation, you wouldn't think anything of it. Look, but I just, as soon as he flashed on the screen, I was like, oh, Kid. And this is the third time I've seen the movie. So it wasn't surprising, but still, I was still like, ah, that's still in there? Oh, shit.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that, like, he's pretty harmless in the movie. He doesn't, he just gives some comments about, you know, his knowledge of death and doesn't really do anything aside from that. So, you know, and like Mark said, you know, some names to help sell tickets or whatever, you know, I'm not mad at it.
Right, right. It does, yeah, like I said, it doesn't stick out in the movie. It's just because I know who Kid Rock is today.
Yeah, for sure.
So let's move on to positives. For me, one of the biggest ones is, I mean, the fucking music. Mm-hmm. I didn't know who Death was until I saw that documentary the first time. I recognized the name, but I was like, oh, is it about that weird 80s metal band? Is this like a documentary about that weird 80s metal band?
Are they from Florida or something?
I think so. I was like, why did somebody make a documentary about some, like...
I think there is a documentary about that band.
Was there.
We should watch it too.
Compare and contrast. Review that one too. Uh-huh. Like, compare them side by side.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe we'll do that next.
Let's do that. Yeah, it could be like our suburbia, suburbia situation.
It'll be that.
But yeah, so yeah, I ended up watching it. And I was like, oh, there was a like it's one of those, like, it ended up being one of those Mandela effect things where I was like, oh, I think I knew that. Mm-hmm. I think I knew that. Did I know that? But I obviously didn't.
No, you didn't.
There's no way I could have. It's like, did I know about them back in the day? No, I didn't. But it was one of those things where I was like, and then I, of course, hunted down their music, which is pretty easy to do at that point.
Yeah.
Because it was just on YouTube. You could find it on YouTube.
Yeah.
I was like, the music, one album. They made one album. As kids, basically.
Yeah.
And it's fucking great.
Hell yeah, it is.
And, of course, just in terms of the film itself, unlike the other documentaries we have reviewed on this podcast, this had a coherent narrative. There was a story.
Yeah, it definitely told a story. It wasn't just, here's the scene, here's Talking Heads talking about this huge amorphous subject. It was focused and told a story, and you know, it wasn't just about music and the band. It was about the family. It was about finding something lost and having a dream kind of come true, you know, after 35 years or whatever it was.
I feel like this is one of those documentaries that even if you're someone who doesn't really like documentaries, my wife's not a big documentary person. She just doesn't really care about documentaries for the most part. Mm-hmm. She loved this movie. She had never seen it. She watched it with me the other night. And she was like, this is a great fucking movie.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't say enough good things about it. I don't know. I mean, the filmmaking in general and how immersive and engaging it is. You know, like I told Mark, the way he shoots documentary films puts you in the middle of the story and is just so engaging. It's hard to look away. It's great.
So I guess we should go ahead and rate it. So we have a rating scale. We have two ways that we rate it. One is how punk is the movie. There's Poser. That's the least punk it could be. There's Punk 'Em or Rocker. That means it's pretty punk, but it could be more punk. Mm. And then there's Upper Crust. That is the most punk. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a crusty movie for all you crusty punks out there.
Right.
That just means that it is the most punk.
Right. Because everybody knows that Upper Crust crusties are the most elitist snobs of all the punk rockers.
That is true. Yeah. You crusty bastards.
Yeah.
And then we have a scale where we measure it based on how good we think it is. What scale are we going to use for that one?
Lost tapes in an attic.
But there were only two, weren't there?
That doesn't have to be our rating scale.
Oh, that's true.
We could do a million lost tapes in the attic.
We can do whatever we want.
Completely arbitrary.
That's the great thing about running your own podcast is no one can tell you how to do it.
No gods, no masters.
That's right. Okay, how many lost tapes?
I was thinking maybe 30 because it was 30 years that it was lost up there.
Oh, okay. What was it? Was it exactly 30?
Yeah, it was close to
30.
It.
30. Okay. All right. So we'll do
which one?
Lost tapes, and we'll do 30 lost tapes because it was approximately 30 years that the tapes were lost. So
okay,
there we go.
I will say 28 out of 30 lost tapes. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get 30 because Wayne Kramer got cut.
Oh, damn.
Through no fault of Mark and Jeff's.
Right. I'm going to also give it, you know, I'm going to beat you. I'm going to go 29.
Fuck.
29 out of 30. Just so we're not the same. I am going to subtract one for Kid Rock.
Okay. Fair enough. Mark can't catch a break for that shit.
But I can't stress enough, it doesn't feel out of place.
No,
at the time, it was fine before we all knew who Kid Rock would become.
And really, Kid Rock only clowns himself, so.
He does. And according to Mark, Kid Rock was actually pretty cordial and friendly.
Yeah.
When he interviewed him.
Some weird beer.
Yeah.
You know, when he was talking about the badass beer, all I could think of was dirt cheap beer.
Yeah, dirt cheap beer, St. Louis, Missouri.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
I just imagine that Kid Rock's badass beer looks and tastes just like St. Louis's own dirt cheap beer.
So yeah, that's I'm giving it 29
lost tapes
out of 30 lost tapes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Sweet.
Yeah, what are you giving it on the punk scale?
Oh, Upper Crust.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I feel like that's a easy one.
Yeah.
It's as punk as it fucking gets. It's a fucking well-made DIY like documentary about a fucking punk band from the 70s that nobody knew about.
Yeah.
So it's an obscure band fucking DIY made documentary. Like, it's just punk as fuck. Yeah. So, yeah.
I think, should we talk about how some of the content is going to be here on Punk Movie Review? And then we're going to, it was a long interview. Mark spent a lot of time with us. So rather than wedge it all into one podcast episode here on Punk Movie Review, I think we're going to probably split it up a little bit and put some of it on Prairie Punk House Companion, just because it delves, it gets away from the actual movie and talks more about the industry. He talks more about some of his other films and about how, you know, talk more about how he got fucked over and how the industry has made it really hard for independent directors, people with a vision, people who value doing things a more old school way. Mm-hmm. Whereas now the industry wants, you know, somebody they can exploit to do multiple tasks and people who went to school for film and had more of a focused skill set are sometimes left behind because they don't have some of these other skills, and it's simply based on exploitation and what they can squeeze out of artists.
Yeah.
So watch for that. I think that'll be next week. Next week's episode. Mm-hmm.
Yep. On our regular schedule.
Yeah,
Prairie Punk House Companion releases every other Saturday. And so, yeah, that'll be the next Saturday, the first, what is that, the first day of March?
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So definitely look out for that. And if you don't subscribe to that podcast, but do subscribe to this one, subscribe to both. And if you do subscribe to that one, but don't subscribe to this one, then subscribe to this one too. You should do that. And you should also visit our Patreon page, become a patron. And you can visit our Ko-fi page, which is so lonely because nobody visits it. And you can find all of our links on our website, www.prairiepunkpress.com. You can find everything there, just right there on the homepage. There's links to everything, including our Blue Sky, our Facebook, our YouTube, our
Instagram.
Instagram.
Threads.
Threads. We're not on Twitter.
Fuck Elon Musk.
Fuck Elon Musk.
No war, but the class war.
So for our next movie, we're doing the 1987 trauma film, Surf Nazis Must Die, which is available on Tubi. What's that?
Imagine that.
Tubi, give us some money. We shout you out on like every episode. So the synopsis for Surf Nazis Must Die is when the son of a gun-wielding woman is murdered by neo-Nazi surf punks in a post-apocalyptic future, his mama hunts them down for some bloodthirsty revenge.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Killing Nazis I've never seen is always it. Fun.
It's directed by Peter George and was written by John Ayer and Peter George. And it stars Gail Neely, Robert Harden, and Barry Brenner. So that'll be household tons names. Of fun. Yeah, I know. Come on, guys. Everybody remembers having that Barry Brenner poster up in their room when they were growing up.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was in Tiger Beat.
All right. Well, yep. I got to take my dog outside. And you gotta go to bed. All right. Yeah. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.
See you next time. Bye.
Sometime in the near future, a major earthquake will lay waste to the entire California coastline. From out of the rubble will rise a menace far more terrifying than the death and destruction. Surf Nazis.
Who rules the beaches?
Surfers rule!
Who rules the surfers?
The beautiful beaches, once the crown jewels of California, are now ruled by ruthless gangs. Only one person is powerful enough, daring enough, brave enough to stop them. Only one person can ensure that surf Nazis must die. She's tough.
I want to buy a gun.
You're talking like trash, but I'm more interested in something that'll take the head off a honky at 20 paces.
She's dangerous. She's all woman. She's Leroy's mama. And as long as she's alive, the surf Nazis must die. First, there was the Road Warrior. Then there was the Terminator. Now comes an action film of relentless excitement.
Taste some of mama's home cooking, Ada.
See the film that is creating a tidal wave of action all over the world. See, Surf Nazis Must Die.